Greetings, Raise community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Jake Heiser, who serves as Vice President of System Philanthropy at Unity Point Health. Welcome, Jake.
Thanks for having me, Brent.
Well, I am really looking forward to this episode because it is going to be an opportunity for me and for our listeners, hopefully, to learn about not only your journey, but some of the similarities and differences across various categories of philanthropy. You've got experience in the Greek life world. You've got experience with the higher education sector, and most recently, healthcare philanthropy. And as you and I have gotten to know each other over the last several months, I've really enjoyed learning from you. And that was the catalyst to invite you to the show today. So before we dive into all of that, though, I do want to learn a little bit more about your own educational journey. So tell me more about Jake in high school. Let's call it junior year. Where were you? Who were you? What were you into? And what led you to Missouri State University?
Well, that's a good question, Brent. I went to a small school in Southwest Missouri and in high school in my junior year. I probably considered myself, like most small town kids, a future athlete of some sort, and was convinced I would be there. And through what I would describe the blessing of an injury, I started to realize at that point in life, maybe I wasn't going to be the next Joe Montana or Michael Jordan or George Brett. And I decided maybe I needed to work on life and what I was going to excel in, and ended up at Missouri State, and just a chance to really grow as a person beyond just a person that saw themselves as an athlete.
All right. So tell me about your town. Which town was it?
El Dorado Springs, Missouri. It's a town of about 3,500 people.
I love it. And just to be clear, first George Brett reference on the podcast in history. So I like that. Yeah. Google him if you're unsure, but a strong presence in El Dorado Springs. And so the reason, as a fellow small town Midwestern kid, that we all want to be famous athletes is because there's literally nothing else to do.
Yeah.
And so you went to Missouri State in Springfield, and tell me more about the experience. Did you love it? Was it a slow start? I know, just kind of give me the impressions when you reflect on the college experience.
I think, you know, again, coming from a small town to a school of 20,000, a bit overwhelming at first. How do you connect and get involved? My sister had been president of her sorority, which was surprising to me when I got there, and connected me to a very successful fraternity. The Phi Delta Theta fraternity had received national recognition for their chapter there, a lot of on-campus awards, and just being surrounded by a lot of leaders, some amazing individuals like Eric Westacott, who had broke his neck but still had amazing perspective on life and really inspired me. And again, that whole journey of trying to think what more I could be as a person, what greater impact could I have? And I credit Phi Delta Theta with a lot of my success and my educational experience.
And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the best parts of a Greek experience is that it can make a big place, you know, small, and really create a connection and frankly, a team mentality, yeah, environment. It's one thing to have a really positive experience in Greek life. It's another thing to decide to go and turn that into your first job. And so just tell me about when that professional path emerged as a possibility and what you reflect on from those couple of years.
I had been given a chance to chapter president, speak at their national conference, and serve as the undergraduate member of a leadership planning committee that they had. And as I went through those experiences, again, small kid going to a large public institution, now at a national conference with people from all over the country, different walks of life, different experiences, I just continued on that journey of how sheltered I was. And when I understood I had the chance at, you know, 22, 23 years old to travel the country, connect with more people, improve my outlook on life, learn from others. And I loved helping people out. I loved making a difference, and so many had given their time to me and thought, you know, what a great opportunity to support individuals in their journey, to help them have a great college experience, and then to go out on my own and see the world. And that chance, Brent, to you're by yourself and you're 22, 23, 24 years old. What do you want to have for dinner? What kind of music do you want to listen to? What do you want to do on a weekend? It was such an amazing experience and really shaped the person I am, and learned so much about myself, learned so much about the world that I perceived differently as a kid in rural Missouri.
I love that. You must have had to travel a lot during those years. I mean, any favorite campuses or trips? It actually reminds me, if you've ever crossed paths with Rod Kirsch, who is now with GGNA, but Rod had a very similar experience. He was on episode 117 of the podcast, coming out of college, working the fraternity for his fraternity on a national level. And yeah, just really fond memories.
Yeah, amazing memories. My kids, we talk about it today. Due to that experience, I grew a love of travel and experience. I've now been to 49 of the 50 US states. Just love to get out. But I will say this, again, shaping my mindset to leadership, to how you approach the world, growth. I still recall going to Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and having the reflection of what happened there. And I still go back to this day and what someone like Abraham Lincoln went through and what the slaves went through, and more US casualties in 3 days in the small town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, than the entire Vietnam War. What were going through people's minds? What were they experiencing? His impact in just 7 minutes in his speech of the Gettysburg Address, wasn't even the focal point speaker that day. The difference you can make just by that, and by continuing to take that next positive step forward when the world is against you. Gettysburg has had a profound impact on me as a person, and just as you face trials and adversity in life, they're for a reason, and you've got to keep pushing forward.
I love it. Very poignant, and appreciate you sharing. And tell me just more about then the path into direct marketing. You spent some time at St. Louis University. I think you connected with Matt White along the way.
Yeah.
Got some of those, let's call it early career memories.
I had been afforded a chance to go into fundraising, leaving Phi Delta Theta headquarters. And my response to Scott Meachin, who was vice president of advancement at that time at Utah State, now Matt White being there, my response was, I could never ask anyone for money. Scott, I wouldn't do it. I went to work for the Gabriel Group. They had a number of clients in the fundraising space in Greek life, and a number of national clients, Ronald McDonald House, Salvation Army, great groups, great organization. And while I was there, I came to this realization, you're not asking people to give their money. People want to make an impact, but they don't know how much it costs to make that impact. What's the difference going to be? You want to buy a new Jeep. You can go online, you can research it, everything you can get for that Jeep. You want to make a difference at a university, at a healthcare system, at, you know, your local zoo, your local church. What does that mean? What does that take? And as I learned that, it went back to my passions about how can I help others? How can I make a difference? And that led me to researching universities. I went back to Scott and said, hey, I want to work in higher ed. He said, well, I don't have the job for you anymore, Jake. And so ended up at St. Louis University, had an interview with their vice president there, a gentleman by the name of Tom Keefe. And I still recall him saying to me, Jake, we have people with more experience, better background than you, but this drive and passion, I'm going to hire you for this job in planned giving. You're going to get to see the whole campus because I believe with your motivation, you want to know one, how to do planned giving. You want to connect with the entire institution. And I think you're going to be a vice president at someday in your career. And it was just 6 years after that that I, after being at St. Louis University for a while, a few years at Bradley University, I became a vice president for the first time.
That's quite a vote of confidence, and it clearly had a made a big impression on you. Tell me about, because you had a unique run at Bradley, 13 years all in, which is rare in this sector or anywhere, frankly. And you started, you know, as a frontline officer and moved your way all the way up. I mean, just tell me about, you know, starting there and you know, did you have the aspiration to be the vice president within a year or two of getting there? I mean, did that sort of immediately land on the vision board, or was it more organic over time?
You know, I had a note on my desk, Brent, that said VP by 40, and I was 31 at the time. And I ended up becoming the VP at 36. And it really wasn't about Bradley. It was about being in that leadership role and continuing to challenge myself. But my time at Bradley, and the reason I ended up there for 13 years, was if you think about higher education today, there's a lot of headwinds, a lot of conflict about how we move forward, a lot of tough decisions that have to get made. And we faced ours just like any other institution at Bradley. But I found this deep connection between myself and the alumni, the donors, the community of Peoria, Illinois, what they were trying to accomplish, an innovative approach, a blend of professional skills with both liberal arts education. And that connection really helped resonate when I was asking them questions, being consultative about their giving opportunities, took on some difficult responsibilities during the time, and those paved the way for some leaders to both on our board, but on our academic side and our administrative side, to see something in me and give me a chance during a time that wasn't the easiest time to honestly say yes to being the vice president, but took that on anyways, and had some great mentors along the way, including our previous vice president, Pat Vickerman, and our CFO, Gary Anna, who coached me a lot, big brothered me when I needed it. And again, just, if you want to do something special, you've got to overcome adversity. And the two of them helped me do that, and made for a great time at Bradley and some great achievements.
What are some of your most poignant memories, ranging from incredible donor stories or crash and burn visits that couldn't have gone worse? I mean, what stands out?
Oh my gosh. Best donor experience. That I can remember was a $10 million ask. And this is against all the rules. I'll tell everyone, you know, the donor didn't, we hadn't aligned on what the number was going into the meeting. It was early on in my career, but I had coached two academic deans going into the meeting. Here were the questions we needed to be asking. The donor knew, but we were trying to get those yeses, get him confident. This is exactly what we want to get done, and this is what we want to achieve. And I had told the deans to continue to ask those questions. And when it came time and I saw the moment that I would actually deliver the ask. So it wasn't mixed. We were building a facility for both business and engineering to bring the two programs more aligned to create opportunities for those individuals. And the conversation was that we would ask this donor for $5 million. And we thought that they would probably give us $1 to $2 million. In the moments, seeing the donor's response, I made the comment about being a lead donor. Donor wasn't a graduate of any of the colleges, and we only had a few people throw stuff up in that way. And I made the request for $10 million. And I had told both the deans, you know, when the ask comes, give the donor some time, give me a chance to field his comments, his thoughts, how we could structure this. And like any fundraiser will tell you, it was quiet for a long time. We were able to field his questions, his responses, and getting that commitment, we were all blown away. Now I tell people, you know, you get more aligned before you get into that meeting. It taught me a lot, but it was a great win.
Tell me more about the, I mean, that's amazing. Like literally on the fly, you just doubled it.
Yeah. I had gotten information about the donor and some resources they had in privately held assets. And the donor had expressed some confidence for the program, and it had expressed some confidence in who he was and his abilities, but pride as well, kind of a silent pride that he wanted to do something special. And as we asked those questions, one of them was, you know, bring these two programs together, having someone that has a depth of understanding in a space, but broad comprehension of the people they're going to partner with, how critical do you see that in our future? And he said, that's the missing link and we have to do it. And knowing how strongly he felt about it, I just felt I wanted to give him an ass that was strong, that he felt like he was making a difference, because he had insinuated with some level of confidence what he had achieved in his life and how he had taken some risks. And I didn't want him to see us in that level. And I said, you know, I want you to be a leader. I want you to be able to do this. I'd like to go ahead and talk to you about what we would consider a leadership gift being. And when I was able to say that, and, you know, I would probably say some of that could have happened in a pre-ask conversation.
Yeah.
It was just, I knew when we asked him that he was comfortable with it. He just needed to figure out the how after that.
So two follow-up questions. One, do you have other situations where you have asked for too much relative to the donor's willingness or comfort level?
Yeah.
It was actually a good thing because you landed in maybe a stronger position. You know, I guess how much of it is do we want to force the tension? There's a fine line between
sure.
intimidating or overwhelming a donor versus challenging them to think even bigger. I guess, is there more of a risk to asking for too much or too little?
So my crash and burn story was too little early on in my career. It was one of the reasons I asked for probably what would be perceived as too much. I asked an individual who owned a private orthopedic practice. I just knew he was a physician there. I did not know he was the owner of the practice for an amount that some of his partners did. And he was insulted. He wanted to take a larger role. On the, to your comment, Brenner, question about, have you asked for too much and created a challenge? That's where I bring up the pre-ask. Later on in my career, I sat down with a donor and we made an ask, and the donor scoffed at it and was kind of offended. And I just went right back at him. And it wasn't really the ask as much as, this is what we'd like to talk to you about. And I said, well, we're just throwing out what the program needs. What information do you need that would help you determine what's the right amount? What's the difference? I know the program is important to you, but beyond importance, there's got to be some information that would help you inform what's the right level of investment. I didn't want to ask about, could he do it? Was he capable? Did he have the capacity? We made those decisions, and probably appropriately so. But we then got that information. So by telling him this is what the difference was, I think we created that line in the sand and then asked him the information he needed. When he saw the information and it lined up, it took us about, I think it was about 12 months till we actually landed the gift. But we started to go through that information, and it was really about the donor didn't foresee the ROI in the gift. And they want to know, it's just like, hey, this is a leadership gift. That gets me to a certain level of giving. That's a nice round number, but what are we really going to accomplish with that gift? And again, great experience for me of asking that question. That was the first time I've asked that question. I've used it several times since then. You know, what do you need? What information you need to inform me about what's the right amount to give? And once he saw some of those impacts, that number started to make a lot more sense to him.
Well, I think you're highlighting, you know, the donor as investor, which continues to develop in the sector, but it's not as much about, do they love the place or the mission, or do they have money? Because generally when you're sitting down in a situation like that, they probably love the place and they probably have the money. And so it's more a question of, do they believe in the what they're buying, right? Whether do they believe for X investment, Y outcome feels right to me. And I think that that's a, you know, obviously a really important part of the philanthropic journey, because that's just what donor investors expect today.
You know, and it's interesting too, and I think it's important to point this out, Brent. In talking to the, you know, I say the donor, he was the alum, and talking to the couple beyond that, one of the things was the convincing of, as a family, why were we going to make this investment? It had to be something more than this is a lead gift. This is a nice round number. This gets our name in lights here. We've accomplished this in life because of sacrifices, making tough decisions, and bringing that knowledge in. If they've achieved that level, just what you said, it's beyond just passion and having the money. They've achieved that level because they've been able to make strong decisions, and they wanted to go through that decision-making paradigm.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've got I'm just thinking of some personal fundraising that I'm involved with right now, and I'm going to not reveal details, although, you know, a close friend had a spinal injury. So I'm just to learn more about some of your past experience with that, but we've been working on ways to raise money to support the family. And what I keep highlighting is the more that we can map, the more we can create a budget, the more that we can map the specific needs to the dollar, the better off we are, because, you know, there's a lot of these, you know, general crowdfunding campaigns where it's, hey, just give now, please give, so-and-so needs help, please give. And obviously that is an important starting point, but, you know, what I'm trying to focus on is like, what are the specific needs? What are the, you know, rent needs or childcare needs or food? Like, how do we start to build a budget so that we're not just sort of arbitrarily asking for money? And I think that's probably, I don't know, something that every fundraiser deals with in some form of.
I couldn't agree more with you, Brent. I find it making the transition from higher ed into healthcare and getting into some of the conversations. I see there's this emotional pull in healthcare that we become very, very comfortable with, and people do care deeply, but they still go through those same checklists of why they're going to make this decision and being able to show those results. And we've evolved as a society. There's so many more people that think of things in an entrepreneurial way and an early investor way. What are we going to get from this? And they understand piloting initiatives. We may not get the results, but we're going to invest here to have this expected outcome. And this is the results we hope to achieve with that. And this is how we're going to evaluate it. And it's powerful when you have that type of information for any investor. Some people want it. Some people, you know, give for other reasons. But when you do have it at your fingertips and available, it just boosts that confidence of this is how you're going to approach the giving.
So tell me about your transition to Unity Point and a couple years in, similarities, differences. We're obviously, you know, speaking about the potential to introduce maybe themes and concepts that are building momentum in the higher ed sector into the healthcare sector. But, you know, what have you learned? Any surprises? I mean, just what stands out a few years in? Or is it basically philanthropy is philanthropy and it's really not all that different?
You know, I came in, philanthropy is philanthropy. This is how you do this work. You know, cultivation work, qualification work, still aligned, impacting the community. You're giving through the organization, not to the organization. All those principles. And for the most part, they're true. I came in with the desire to do large campaigns and challenges to think big. And what I found is, where are we at in our process? One of the biggest differences between higher ed and healthcare is oftentimes in higher ed, the president, the CEO, the chancellor is a practitioner of philanthropy. They've heard from donors. They've went through some of those consultative relationships. So when they get involved in any strategic planning, they're thinking about philanthropy in the back of their mind, or they understand how to partner with that external audience. When you get into healthcare, that's not as frequent. So it's how do you pull in philanthropy? How do you mature to that point of being into a large comprehensive campaign? You just can't do it overnight. Otherwise, you've got a lot of people doing that for the first time. The other big experience I've noticed in healthcare versus higher ed, in higher ed, qualification work is really, really important because you have all these alums who have good intentions to give. Oftentimes as undergraduates, they're starting to be educated on the role philanthropy plays in the institution, but they, I'm going to give in the future. And you're trying to qualify to create some urgency with that group of now we got to make this commitment. How are you going to do it? Are you ready now? In healthcare, the difference really is qualification is probably even more important because you're working through grateful patients. You're trying to identify, you need to introduce new donors. It's much more complex because it's not this relationship of, hey, I adore my alma mater. I've always been there. it's a very private relationship between a physician, the care they've received, the difference they want to make. It's much higher passion. So when you go through that qualification, what I've found oftentimes is to break that ice, you got to move a lot more considerately with donors and prospects, and be thoughtful about how fast you're moving them. But once you get them there, because it's so much about passion, because it's so much about gratitude, it's getting spiked very, very quickly. So you have that deep passion. It's a little bit harder for qualification. So when we do that, one of the challenges we find is we end up going to more conventional, broader-based donors, oftentimes in healthcare, like our large business communities, like some of our influential community leaders that hear from a lot of organizations, because it's qualification is hard work in healthcare. But it is, when you do it well, and it's a journey we're on right now, when you do it well, the spike is outstanding, and there's great organizations that do it extremely well. But the principles are still the same. You just may move down the journey in a different pace and a different cadence. And that's been a wonderful learning experience for me to think, this is how you approach the donor. Same way as I approach the campaigns. This is where you want to be. You know, you want to be this, get down the road much quicker than you are. But how you get the pace, your acceleration comes at different times in healthcare versus higher education.
One of the things we've talked a lot about is the maybe some of the similarities and the challenges in that there are, you know, there's a giving pyramid. There's a very tippy top of the giving pyramid that is generally covered through one-to-one assignment with major gift officers. And then there's a whole host of other people in the community attending the events, you know, going through as patients, making, you know, modest donations that are just sort of in the middle.
Yeah. And
it's not really clear what the potential is or how many of those kind of hidden gems are there. That seems to me fairly similar to what we're seeing in higher ed, but do you view it any differently?
No, and I think because it's probably even more complex to uncover perhaps in healthcare. I still remember part of my journey that led me into healthcare. I was, as part of my life, I got to promote a startup nonprofit organization, the Dax Foundation, whose first goal was to raise $1.6 million to run St. Jude's for a day. And Julie Lockmore was its founder. There is a great song, One Last Christmas by Matthew West, that is about Dax's story. Julie is an inspirational individual. And through her work and her impact and my involvement and connection to that organization, they went out and they helped raise money for Ronald McDonald House with OSF Hospital in Peoria. And I still remember being there when they did the grand opening, and there were three donors that were being highlighted. And I was the vice president of the major university in the community, so I thought I knew all the best prospects in the community. I didn't know one of the three donors, and they all made significant gifts. And I remember thinking to myself, there is a lot of passion, a lot of resources, a lot of appreciation that it's out there hidden in different spaces. And how do you get to those individuals? How do you create those conversations? And it's a highly personalized world nowadays, and people want to have that dialogue and try to understand, just like we talked about with those major gift experiences, why should I give that much? What information do I need to help me understand that? Do people naturally do this? And because they had a connection in this case to someone like Julie, who they could just have an honest conversation with, it started to open their eyes to items and opportunities that maybe they never believed could be possible. And to see the joy in their eyes when they made that gift. And that's that passion. You see a lot of enthusiasm for your higher ed gift. You do see the crying every now and then, but when you see it in healthcare, when that person has found an outlet for something they deeply want to do, it's a very special experience.
Love it. Thank you for sharing. Now, when we kind of have reconnected, I think in December, you told me that you're in the midst of interviewing people in the industry just to understand staff issues, experience opportunities. Tell me more about your approach to building relationships at different institutions with different leaders. And any insights that you feel like you've been able to develop through those conversations, or maybe even key anecdotes that have stuck with you?
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up, Brent. I have become very passionate about our industry. It's made an amazing career for me, as I said earlier, that I didn't want to do at first, and now I can't imagine doing anything else. And at the same time, I see professionals, whether they're in the leadership role or a frontline fundraiser, tormented, wanting to do more, wanting to have a greater impact, having too many responsibilities and not enough time to do it. And I sought out to better understand that. So I did want to interview a lot of people and understand through their own eyes what was going on. I would relate back to my time at Unity Point coming here. I had these perceptions of this is what works. I know this. I've raised a lot of money. Now put yourself in their shoes. Understand what they're going through. And I've tried to take a disposition of just seeking to understand. I take the same thing to my fundraising approach, asking questions of all kinds connected to fundraising. The interview process, I interviewed consultants, I've interviewed fundraising leaders, fundraising managers, people that have left the industry, current frontline fundraisers, board members, executives that have work in a peripheral role with philanthropy. What are they seeing and what are they going through? And one of the common threads that I've seen is this in our space. First of all, the demand far outweighs the supply for fundraisers and fundraising leaders in our organizations. So coming up with ways to onboard those individuals, give them the correct skills and help them excel and perform is critical to our future success. Philanthropy is so important to our communities, but we often don't have enough bandwidth to do that. So how do we introduce opportunities? How do we introduce programs that teach those skills that have a strong methodology of growth and development and how you have success with donors, I think is very, very important. Building bandwidth for those leaders, I would encourage every leader I know, go out and find a deep thought partner. We think we're so busy and we're creating that busy because we're always playing catch up and we never have enough time to really come up with a strong solution. Take the time. I try to find time every Friday to have a call outside of my world that helps me gain perspective and improve that. I refine my approach. I save time. I look at solutions in a different way. And I think about the pressures that I went into. I was 36, first-time vice president, thought I knew everything, thought I could do everything. And it was hard. And I went through a lot of those pressures on my own. I learned on the job. Go out there and find people to talk to. Find individuals like Evertrue and Brent who have innovative solutions to what we're doing that have gotten a master's class by talking to so many of these organizations. Broaden your horizons, but there's a theme that I think is important for all of us to apply to, and this is why I went out and did those interviews. Barrier identification and barrier resolution. We continue to see turnover in our industry. Well, let's go out and identify those barriers. What's really going on? A lot of the young professionals that we think just want to jump around because they're millennials, it's not what they want. They want a real plan for how they can make a difference for your organization because that's what inspires them. That's what motivates them. But they feel they can work themselves and work themselves and work themselves to no end. And there's no real plan for the difference they can continue to make. Managers want those same things, but they don't have enough time in their day. So they don't invest enough time in building those career maps, building those plans for individuals, understanding if they hit X, what they're going to give them for Y. And leaders are required to be in every space. Strategic planning, finance, lead prospects, recruitment and retention of fundraisers. None of us have enough time. Get in there and find those deep thought partners and then take the time to identify what the real barrier is and then build a solution to it.
So you're making me think of a couple of books that I've read. One is called The Obstacle is the Way, which is kind of,
Yes.
you know, that's right in line, which I recommend everybody check it out if you're not familiar. And then there's another one called The One Thing, sort of the power of just focus in a world where we're getting bombarded and spread too thin. And that's where when I hear, you know, oftentimes, like you just said, people don't have enough time. Usually, and like this is a lot of what we're trying to hopefully inspire through our work at Evertrue is you know, there are a few things that if fundraisers could just spend more time doing in a consistent way,
Yeah.
lead to more conversations, and more conversations lead to philanthropy. And so, you know, part of it is like the calendar audit of what percent of my time not doing the thing that is the most important to my primary role, generating philanthropy for the mission. And so, like, what are your thoughts on that, just philosophically? And as you think about your consultative role supporting multiple institutions across a system, you know, some of this is like, how do we just do the really basic things well and consistently? And that is simple, but boy, it is not easy.
I love that you brought up The Obstacle Is the Way. I think it's a great book. I encourage everyone to read it. And I think we get put in these positions in life to challenge us, to make us think. When we sit there, if you find yourself saying, I don't have enough time, maybe you're really being told, challenge that idea of what time is, where you're investing your time, how you're utilizing your time. I don't have enough prospects in my portfolio. How well are you really cultivating? How really, really qualifying? Are there people there? My success in my career has actually been able to better understand the prospects in my portfolio. And I was told there weren't any good prospects. And those individuals, I've had more than 30 gifts of 7 and 8 figures in my career. And oftentimes they're either sitting embedded in my portfolio and no one thought they had that ability, or I did some great qualification work, but asking those questions. And you talked about that time of calendar planning. And I want to give a little bit of a shout out to our Meritor Foundation or Madison campus at Unity Point. Rebecca Madsen, the foundation president there, brought that question to me earlier in the year, and or at the end of last year. I've got to find more time. I've got to do this. We had a wonderful conversation. And instead of pulling herself out of meetings, Rebecca and I were talking about, where are you the most productive? When are these meetings better than those meetings better? When do you have time? And she did an audit, just like you said. And I was there just a few weeks ago, and she shared with me the results of that audit. And when we take off, you think, okay, I'm busy, so I've got to take things away. You see very driven individuals almost feel guilt because they had to back away or take away for something. And then they miss something. So then they're frustrated. They miss something. Rebecca, who did the audit, who challenged herself, the energy and enthusiasm, when she was sharing that story with me, I've planned a better schedule. Now I've reapproached it. I've figured out I can do it. And this is the way I'm going to do it. The motivation she has into this year and going from a person, her line was, I felt like I was working very intentional. And when I went through that audit, I realized I wasn't. If you have that opportunity, we want to do it with donors. We want them to become self-reflective. Have that opportunity just to be self-reflective and say, not to say, here are the problems, but here's what I can do to address it. Here's the questions I can ask myself. The results are so rewarding. And again, part of the reason I went out and done those interviews, I don't want to make assumptions. I want to go out and really understand and comprehend. It makes you a better fundraiser when you do that. So why don't you apply it to everything else you do?
So where do you see things going from here? What are you excited about in the industry? And as we start to conclude, I want to make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you as well.
Absolutely. Where I see things going in the university is we're all talking about this trend of the number of donors slipping down and down and down and raising more money, but from fewer donors. And that's starting to even level out right now. I think what's important for all of us is, how are we connecting with that larger group and understanding the world we live in today? You know, everything I've tried to say is ask questions, seek to understand type of mindset, take on some of those challenges. It's a much more personalized world today. People want to have those deep connections. People want to have a deeper understanding. They just don't transactionally give the same way. So what are you doing to increase those conversations, to open more doors, I think is so critical. People think of their giving in different ways than they did to before. They want to test items out. They have an approach. I always think about angel investing or venture capital. They want to test something out. They want to do that Series A financing. I'm going to get in early on. I'm going to see how things go. And then I'm going to see how it progresses from there. It's the same way as the annual fund, but you got to approach it in a different way. It's not just make a gift and we're not going to communicate back to you anything else. It just went blindly into the organization. We're piloting ideas. I think those are very important. But I am very intrigued by the whole notion, Brent. What are the challenges we're seeing? We have to. Our job as fundraisers is to solve problems. So this idea of fundraiser retention, this idea of losing donors, we've got to seek to understand the same way we do with our donors. So get out there. You know, I love connecting with individuals. I hope people will reach out to me, you know, and just send me an email at jacob.heiser@unitypoint.org, and I can get that to you. But I'd love to connect, reach out to me on LinkedIn. Because those conversations, that deep thought partner that I talked about before, these are real challenges that we're all talking about at every conference. And that was the reason for the outreach for everyone. I kept hearing about retention and recruitment issues. Okay. What are you seeing? What are you doing? Same thing with the fundraisers, the number of donors going down. Let's talk about this and let's come up with real solutions.
Well, that's where, you know, and this is not meant to be an Evertrue pitch at all, but you know, we heard those issues. Hey, we have a huge around talent retention and concerns around donor pipeline. And at the same time, we're sitting there looking at the university space in particular saying, wait, you're concerned about talent strategies? Like, you are the universities that create talent pools. And we went and we looked and we saw, geez, you've got a call center with a diverse set of kids that are literally asking for money. And you're not hiring those students into entry-level fundraising roles. What if we could craft a concept like the DXO, the Donor Experience Officer, that would both create a talent on-ramp from the student population that is hidden in plain sight and go address the middle of the pyramid donor pipeline that, similar to the stories you've shared, can oftentimes result in seven-figure plus opportunities from people who just have not had that personalized connection. And I'm really proud, you know, we're a few years into that now, that it is becoming a very fast growing part of the industry, but it you know, is sort of an example of like, well, what's the obstacle? Talent pipeline, donor pipeline. I see students, I see middle of the pyramid, let's go.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Brent, I go back to what I said earlier. I don't have enough time. We said that. When we first talked, I shared with you, I've kind of admired you from afar. That guy's really, you know, entrepreneurial. He's always challenging the system. But I never took a call with Evertrue. I never reached out and set up a meeting with Evertrue because early on in my career, I didn't have enough time. I was learning on the job and I didn't seek out those thought partners. I think about those things now and I take all those meetings now because people like you, that's what you spend your day doing. How can we solve these problems? I'm hearing about it. I'm developing a company to be your thought partner in doing this stuff. And you've got to get out of those shells. You got to get out of those meetings. Talk to your peers. You know, we've mentioned Matt White's name a couple of times. I always reach out to Matt and we have these conversations about what's he doing? What am I doing? What are some of the challenges he's facing? How can we work together? We promote that in our own organizations and working with philanthropy. Do it with our partners. Do it with our peers. I would, if I could give any advice to anyone, a deep thought partner, take those calls with some of your the organizations you work with, some of those consultants out there, some of those solutions that have been developed. I had a call earlier this week with an organization. I didn't know who they were. I was like, you know, you got to keep taking those calls. And I got done with the meeting. I got done with the conversation. Like, that's a great approach. We're not quite ready for that now, but that really made me think, even if you don't sign on with them, how does it get you outside of your current space to solve the problems that are occupying all your time?
I love it. Great thoughts. And I am grateful that you have taken our call and that you've been able to get to know each other a bit and look forward to continuing to advance those conversations. We have so much to learn as we, you know, grow our footprint in the healthcare sector. And, and you know, you and others can really, I think, help us help be a bridge to ensure that we understand the similarities and differences and nuances from higher ed to healthcare. So thank you, Jake, for that and for your time today.
I appreciate you bringing these conversations forward, Brent, and the way you approach things, the way you ask questions, and just inspire people to, just like we do with donors, just take a minute and think about it.
Thank you, Jake. I appreciate it. And with that, I would encourage everybody reach out to Jake Heiser, rhymes with Anheuser, last name spelled H-E-U-S-E-R. Look him up on LinkedIn, reach out, very active there as well. And with that, I look forward to being in touch. Jake, we'll conclude today's episode with Jake Heiser, Vice President of System Philanthropy at Unity Point Health. Take care, everybody.
Thanks.